This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Chris Offutt. He's the author of a memoir called My Father, the Pornographer. It's a great title, obviously, really immediately drags you into it and makes you wonder what's going on. Chris is a novelist, a short story writer. He's written two memoirs before this one, and you've also written for television as well. So I'm really glad to be able to talk to you, Chris.
Well, thanks for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure. And, you know, this particularly was interesting to me, although, you know, my father was a writer. He wrote at home. I spent years mm-hmm. having to get out of his way. And, you know, one of the things that about this book that that kind of vibrated for me instantly was this, you know, you talked a lot about your father's state of being while at home when he was writing. Now, your story is, I mean, the story of your father is really interesting, you know, that he had been a successful insurance salesman and built up a really big business for himself in Kentucky, and then decided to throw it all in or throw it all away and start over as a writer. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what that was like.
Well, when it happened, I was 10 when he made that decision, age 10. And, you know, my memory of before that was just Dad being gone a lot during the day to make appointments for his insurance company. He had an office in a main office in Moorhead, and then he had two other branch offices in towns nearby, and he would travel between them and meet with clients. And he'd had a few people working for him. And then in the evenings, he would go out again. He would come home and eat supper, and then he would go out in the evenings often to close at the sales. So that was pretty much his life. On the weekends, he would spend all day Saturday typing, and partly Sunday. He would write at night longhand until 2 or 3 in the morning, and then get up and be a salesman. So then on the weekends, he would just type it all. And during that time, it was better than we were not in the house, because Dad liked it quiet when he did all the typing, and would get upset by distractions. Then when he decided, he was about 36, he was very unhappy, and he decided to, he would be a writer. He'd always been interested in writing and had always written, studied English in college, and won high school writing contests, and then a nationwide college writing contest in science fiction. And I think by his first novel came out that same year that he decided to be a writer. So anyhow, he shut down his insurance company and fixed up a room in the house to work in. And suddenly Dad was home all the time. He went from being gone most of the time to being in the house most of the time. So that was a very drastic change in his routine and in the entire fabric of the family's life.
And in the book, you talk a lot about what it was like for you as children growing up with, you know, this very volatile guy. I mean, it wasn't just that he was wanting peace and quiet while he wrote. He seemed to be a complicated guy emotionally, to say the least. You know, not necessarily easy for anyone to get along with. I mean, you talked a lot about, you know, some of his relationships with other people in the world were complicated and challenging, but with children, I think it's really difficult. You have three siblings, right? So there are four of mm-hmm. you, and you all had to be fearful of this kind of volatile guy who sounded like he was not so happy to have children in the first place.
Well, I don't think he was. I think that he saw children as a distraction. He didn't like kids. He didn't really like pets. He didn't like anything that required care. He had kids as a result of having come of age in the early 1950s and being raised Catholic. He thought that was what was expected of him, in the same way that he thought going into business for himself was expected of him in that sort of mid-century, just post-war way of looking at American life. I think it was easier for him to give up Catholicism and give up cell insurance, but he couldn't really give up the children the same way. He didn't. I think he didn't want to leave his family, but he didn't really want to put up with too much from the kids either.
Well, it could, you know, he probably needed your mother to take care of him. It sounds like he was a pretty needy guy.
Well, Mom took care of him. I mean, while he was gone, she took care of us. We were all young. And they waited until my youngest sister was in first grade to make this big change, when Mom had more time at home and could do all of Dad's typing. That was essentially what she did. She had learned how to type in a 1 year class after she graduated from high school. Dad never learned to type. He taught himself with three fingers, but was could type incredibly fast. His record was 93 pages in one day, for example. But he also made a lot of mistakes, and Mom did all the final typing for him during the day. So when they sort of undertook this big change into the life of a writer, Mom's focus shifted more to Dad, and I was the oldest, and so I kind of had to take care of my younger siblings more. We kind of, you know, when Dad came home, we didn't really gain the father so much as we in many ways lost the attention of our mother.
Right. So he kind of took over and took over her instead of having her take care of you.
Well, she was working. Part of it was she was actually doing this work at home. It was all of his typing and correspondence. So there was that element of it. And then Dad, as it just sort of shifted into her giving him more and more attention, taking more and more care of him. You know, a home office in ideally is you have a house, you have your home, and then you have an office where someone works separate from the home. But with Dad's case, it sort of shifted, and over time the home became just an extension of his office until it wasn't too long before the entire house was seen by him as his office and his work area, which included my mother and also included, you know, the activities that were allowable in one's office, for example. In other words, the home became less of a home and more of an office in its entirety.
Right. So one thing about him that, I mean, obviously there's a lot to tell you. You wrote a whole book about him, but his, mm-hmm. what struck me was the sheer output of his writing is just astonishing. And you talked about that, you know, there's a list of all the books that he wrote and published. Mm-hmm. But he was kind of he seemed to have a certain amount of obsessive personality. You know, you talked about from really an early age, he had this project going on where he was creating a homemade graphic novel, essentially a comic book that he illustrated and wrote that went on for thousands of pages about a world that he invented. And as a science fiction writer, he was creating other worlds. And science fiction writers, many of them wrote lots of novels. You know, I know from the, you know, that other science fiction writers in the 50s and 60s had a tremendous output, partially because they had to make a living and they were getting paid by the word in some cases. I think your father stands out for just the sheer number of books he was able to write.
Well, it's hard to compare. He wrote and published 30 novels under his own name. Those were, I think, two or three, maybe science fiction. The bulk of them were fantasy, heroic fantasy novels. So in the Conan kind of a vein. The other 380 or so books were all porn. And it's hard to know how, you know, I think that's a lot of books. I'm not sure if he believed that he was the most prolific and the best porn writer of the 20th century. It's hard to know if that's true. It would take a scholar to calculate and make this evaluation.
Right. You'd have to read a lot of porn.
You would have to read it, and you have to keep it all straight, and you'd have to be aware of all the different pseudonyms and everything. But Dab was of that generation of writers who were just pulp machine, so to speak. They just were prolific as hell. Part of it was the pay was so low. Even in the 40s and the 50s and to the 60s, it was very low pay, but there was a steady demand. And if you could just get the books out there, you could, you could make a living of a kind. Then the porn market opened up in the late 60s, and Dad and many other science fiction writers kind of jumped ship over into that market because it was so demand. There was such demand for it, and you could actually write the porn faster. Science fiction readers are more discerning. They want an intact world. There's a more characterization. There's more description. There's a more cohesion to the best of science fiction. Whereas, you know, the porn at a certain point was just boy meets girl, and their personal activities for 140 pages.
What kind of got you to write this book was your father passing away, and then you mm-hmm. you became the person who decided to go through everything that was in the house and mm-hmm. kind of you appointed yourself to the task of essentially being his literary executor. And none of your siblings were not interested in this, I think.
Right. Nobody really was interested in it. Dad had not, he hadn't worked in his office in 10 or 15 years. By the time he died, he was sick and couldn't get up and couldn't get around very easily. And so it was just this big room full of dust and books and manuscripts and a mess, really. And after he died, my siblings and I, we began clearing out the house to help my mother, and she moved. So we just kind of saved Dad's office for last without really deciding to do that, other than we were going to need a lot of space to move that stuff out and just see what there was. By this time, we had known that Dad had written porn. The family did. We didn't know the extent of it, of course. But my siblings had no interest in going through it. They preferred to destroy it all. I thought it would just be easier, which it would have been, to just make a, send it to the dump or make a big fire or something. But I didn't share that attitude. And I'm not even sure why. Part of it was curiosity about Dad and a chance to get to know him through his work, because he was made himself hard to get to know while he was alive. The other part was, as a writer myself, I really thought that he deserved a bibliography, and as any writer deserves one, and he had never made one for himself. In the meantime, I discovered on the internet there's a lot of science fiction websites, and they had information about Dad that was just incorrect. So I thought, well, I'll put together a bibliography and send it to a few of these websites and just say, look, here it is. Here's the final word. And there you go. And that project turned into a 3-year undertaking that produced a book and finally a bibliography of 400 books under 17 pseudonyms. Yeah.
It is amazing. No, he is really, I can see how it became so powerful to be involved. I mean, first of all, it's a way for you to wrestle with your father as a, you know, as a influence and as a person that was not so easy for you to get along with when you were young and he, you know, growing up. But you could see how, just at least it seemed to me, you would become almost fascinated with all of these different identities that he took. And you talked a lot about his connections with people that, you know, some of us have heard of. I mean, the fact that he went and met with Barney Rossett, that was pretty interesting. You know, he's Barney was a pretty important guy. And Grove Press is really one of the most important publishing companies of our time. In fact, I read and interviewed a guy who wrote a book about Grove and about how important it was to American culture in opening doors for so many. I mean, we forget how recently it was that, you know, the pornography was blatantly illegal. You would, you know, obscenity laws prevented those books from being published.
Well, Dad was a huge fan of Grove Press and had been buying books from Grove for many years. And had tremendous admiration for Rossett. Rossett had, you know, done legal battle with the government at least twice on obscenity grounds, and Rossett won. I think it probably bankrupted him in the process, but he won. And Dad considered him a hero of America and literature, and the First Amendment. Oh, I'm not sure which one it was. Just freedom. And when Dad had an opportunity to work for Rossett, it was, he really felt like he had arrived. It was his crowning achievement and something he loved more than anything. It was in the early 70s, I believe. He wrote a series, a historic series, pornographic series set during the time of the Crusades. Dad was a great scholar of the medieval times and edged weapons and military history and history in general, and loved it. And combined, he loved to write porn set in historic times, or essentially historical novels with every 30 or 40 pages there'd be pretty hardcore pornographic passages. And he did that with about the Crusades. And it was a young guy who saved Richard the Lionheart's life and then became one of his trusted generals over time. I think there were four books in his series, and then a fifth one was a little bit later. But Dad loved that, and he loved Rossett. It was just it was also the first time that he had a contract for a pornographic work was with Grove Press. That meant a lot to him too.
Oh, I was going to ask you about just that point. When he wrote these books, they would send him a check for whatever it was, $600, $800. Were those essentially treated as work for hire that he would write?
It was all work for hire.
Right. So
he
writes the novel and he has no ownership. In other words, so you now looking at that list of books, those are books that he wrote, but whoever those publishers were paid for them, and the rights belong to those publishers.
Well, yes and no. They weren't contracted for ahead of time, which is the case with contemporary writers. I have the same opportunity. You know, I either get a contract ahead of time or I write something and then sell it. With the porn and a lot of science fiction, a lot of genre novels in general, that's the case, or certainly was the case. It didn't mean you gave up the copyrights necessarily. And Dad had been, was a businessman. He was a very savvy businessman, and he retained the copyright to the pornographic novels, and wrote letters to make sure that he did, which are part of his archive as well. But you know that industry, it was a criminal industry in many ways. They were breaking the law on a number of fronts, breaking federal law, breaking IRS laws. Postmaster General was the last word in obscenity for a long time in this country, which is absurd when you think about it. That's who would decide if something was obscene or not. It was all about using the federal post office as a means to send material that could be offensive across state lines and everything. So, as a result, these publishers were not really concerned with things like copyright. You know, they could, if they were short on a manuscript, they would just republish the same book under a different name and put a different cover on it and not pay the original writer anything. So they were, not all of them were like that, and certainly not Grove, but some of them were in the business of, making money for themselves without regards to the writer or the painter of the cover art or anything like that. And I think Dad treated them the same way. I mean, part of the reason he had so many pseudonyms was so that one publisher would not know he was publishing with a competitor, for example.
Right. Right. And also it would allow him to switch genres, you know, because you'd become associated with a certain kind of writing and you'd need another name for another kind of writing.
Well, you can get, there's such a thing as becoming, flooding the market, being too prolific. You know, if there's one, if somebody has four books out in 1 year, well, you're going to, at a certain point, and then six and X and eight, at a certain point, there's going to be diminishing returns in terms of readers. But a fresh new name might be different. And sometimes he would use different names for different sort of subcategories within the genres of porn. But at the same time, Dad did not see, he did not share this view of that I'm talking about, which is having 16 or 17 pseudonyms. Dad had one alter ego. That's how he looked at it. That alter ego's name was John Cleave. John Cleave had stationery. He had his own wardrobe. He had a signature that was stylized and very different from Dad's. And it was John Cleave who had 16 pseudonyms. That was how Dad saw it. Not that he had 17, but that his alter ego, John Cleave, was responsible for the 16 pseudonyms. I don't fully understand that. I've always been curious about it. There's an element of safety and protection, I think, to having these sort of mental partitions in terms of distance from who he was and what he was up to.
Right. Well, and you mentioned that in when you were talking about some of his very personal writing that you came across indicates he was fairly tortured about his sense of self, and that maybe that alter ego is a way for him, as you say, to put some distance between the self that he did not mm-hmm. like and the other self that he, felt more comfortable in.
Well, I think that's, I don't think he liked Andy Offit. I really think that he had learned a great strong dislike for himself as a child, and a lot of what he did was to try to offset that, engage in politics in college, and then a successful businessman, and I'm not sure it helped, but the creation of John Cleave was made all the difference in the world, because Dad really liked being John Cleave. He loved it. And John Cleave was an alter ego who wrote these books, but John Cleave was also a happier man. John Cleve didn't have children, for one thing. And John Cleve was much more charismatic and funny and, kind of a playboy and a raconteur. And so being John Cleve was a way to really make Dad feel better about himself. And I think that's what, you know, having all these different different clothes and stationery and all sort of helped add to that that sensation that John Cleve was real in his imagination.
So was he the character that your father became? You know, you talked about him going to these to the cons, going back for a lot, you know, actually to the very early period of them starting in the, and, you know, you, he would drag you and your mother to this, to these convocations, where he could be this famous writer. And was that the John Cleve character then acting out in public?
I think that with time that became that way more. It was, you know, you have to bear in mind that that where I grew up and where Dad lived was deep in the Appalachian foothills of eastern Kentucky in Round County. Round County was very well known last fall for having been where the county clerk refused to issue marriage licenses to gay couples, which is a horrible thing. But it's an example of the level of conservative thought that is at work in that part of the country. So, you know, living there full time meant keeping this a big secret. Going to the science fiction conventions beginning in the early 70s was a place where Dad could cut loose from the strain of living of this secret life and could be John Cleve. And I think over time, the John Cleve persona sort of grew, especially when he was at these conventions. Since the publication of his book, I've talked to a few people who knew Dad from that time, some friends and some fans, and they have told me that they realized that the person they knew was the John Cleve persona. And after reading the book, it confirmed a few things because they had seen, as they said, the mask slip at the cons, and they had been confused by this other side of Dad. And really what they were seeing was not another side of Dad, but they were seeing Andy Offit, the real Andy Offit, rather than the persona that was crafted for public consumption, but also most importantly that he loved embodying.
Right. Oh no, that's an amazing. I was really captivated by your description. That, I mean, a lot of the book is just wonderful, and I really liked reading the whole thing. But I really felt that there was this just. I was transported when you were talking about being a kid at the conventions and, you know, observing. You know, you have a great viewpoint at that age to see adults in a different way. And of course, as an adult now, you have a deeper understanding of them. But I thought that was a really, you know, that was in a very evocative part of the book. And of course, there are many parts that I thought, you know, were about you. The book is not just about your father. A lot of it is you in your story of in relation to your father. And I wanted to ask you about the fact that you're a writer, you know, that, you know, it kind of feels like that's an, you know, a direct connection to your father that you must think about sometimes. And
I've thought about it a lot, and I try to address it in the book. There are Dad and I are very alike in many ways. Yes, we have the same occupation, but it's also an unusual occupation to begin with, one that requires solitude, a certain degree of intelligence, a very strong discipline, and a willingness to sort of live cheap and make sacrifices in order to, you know, produce some kind of body of work. So we're very similar in personality, but our interests are extremely different. There have been times when I wondered if I was a writer simply because of Dad. You know, did I want to be? Was I just a boy trying to copy his father, or was I a boy who wanted to enter his father's business and be better than him? Or was I still this little child who realized that the only way I could get Dad's attention was to write a story when I was little because he was interested in that? I've since discarded all those because, I think it's kind of a cheap pop psychology way of looking at things. And also, it doesn't hold up. You know, it just, with maturity and age and wisdom, I'm still doing it. You know, I'm still writing on new work. So I have thought about a lot of those things. Now, my dad's own father, my grandfather, I never knew him. He died young, had wanted to be a writer, and had written literary short stories aimed at the magazine market in the 20s of the, you know, when a writer could actually make a good living writing short fiction. And, the Atlantic Monthly, I think, was around. There were a lot of periodicals on the East Coast. Yeah. I can't remember all the names.
Well, there was Scribner's Magazine and Atlantic and Harper's. And there were just tons. I mean, they actually literally could. There were a number. I've studied some of the writers from that period that we've never heard of because they were popular in the 20s, published lots of short fiction, and then kind of disappeared. But you could make maybe not a great living, but you could certainly make a living or enhance your living by writing part-time. And there was a market for writing, for short fiction.
There was. And I think my grandfather had that in mind and wanted to do that, was writing for those, for that market of it. But then the Depression came along and he had to set aside those ambitions to really the work to save the family land, and then died before he could ever return to it. So, you know, I'm just bringing it up that perhaps there's a genetic component. I don't know. But at this point, you know, one key difference between Dad and me is this, is he died and I wrote a book about him. If I had died while he was alive, I really doubt if he would have written a book about me.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it, although not fair to yourself, I think, in some ways. But so you write fiction and you write memoir. You've written three books of memoir now. And do you, I know this is really in some ways a stupid question, but do you have a preference for fiction or memoir? Is there, do you draw the distinction? Does, or just, it doesn't really matter. It's whatever strikes your need at a particular time.
I would think it's a different, there's different concerns. For one thing, it's what the narrative itself requires. Look at it this way. I wrote this book about, Dad, as a memoir, as nonfiction. And the reason is it would have been impossible to fictionalize it and make it better. Not the book better, but to make the story better. And in fact, I think if I'd published a novel about a guy in the hills of Kentucky who wrote 400 porn novels, people would have laughed it off the desk, you know, and it would never have gotten in print because it was too ludicrous of an idea. Whereas with nonfiction, it's just more suitable to it. You know, the book I'm working on now is set in Eastern Kentucky in the 50s and 60s, and I think it might even hit 1970. It has to be fiction because, you know, I wasn't around then, you know, in the 1950s, with sufficient memory to write about, you know, a guy coming back from Korea, the Korean War, as a veteran at age 17. So it's really, it's the story itself or the narrative itself that dictates to me what kind of book it's going to be. The only difference, I to me, they're very similar. If it's a similar toolbox, so to speak, description, characterization, dialogue, pace, and structure. The big difference is that with nonfiction, you pretty much know the story already. And that takes the pressure off invention. You're not inventing as you go. Whereas with fiction, as you write, particularly a first draft, you have to make everything up as you move forward. And that's an extra pressure. It can also be a tremendous fun. You can wind up writing things that surprised me. The only other difference, I think, is that because that pressure is gone, I was talking about of invention, it allows me at least to feel to have a greater sense of freedom in terms of structure for nonfiction. And this book about Dad covers enormous amounts of time in America from 1945 to 2015, and covers his life, my life, a lot of our overlap. And then also each chapter moves around in time, while hopefully the whole thing is moving forward in a cohesive narrative. So that kind of freedom to explore structural narrative is easier for me in nonfiction.
Great. Well, that's
a long-winded answer to a simple question.
A really, really good answer to a simple okay. question, which I really appreciate. So, okay. I think the writing is terrific in this book. I really want to just say that. And I read a couple of your short stories just so I could. I hadn't read your novels, so I wanted to mm-hmm. get a feel for your work, and I was just mm-hmm. Captivated by your stories. So, I want to thank you for that. And
I appreciate it.
Oh, this is a terrific book. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk about it.
You bet.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Chris Offutt about his memoir, My Father, the Pornographer. Thank you so much, Chris.
You bet. See you later.